Man, it's so good to be here with you again and see you again, connect again, brother. Yeah, this is really good. And are you wearing planar headphones? What do you got there?
They, I know these look like Princess Leia headphones. They're so ridiculously large. They're the Audies LCDX, which are a little over the top.
No,
high quality, but they were sitting here, and I couldn't find my smaller profile ones.
Please,
hear you in full fidelity right now.
Man, you never have to apologize to me for wearing a pair of Audies. Those headphones are amazing.
Yeah, they're kind of heavy, but they're totally open, so like I can hear everything in the room. But Buddy turned me on to these, and they're pretty great, pretty awesome for mixing and listening, just referencing on headphones.
They really are, yeah. And I agree with the heaviness. If they could figure out how to make those like a little smaller and 50% less heavy, then and I guess probably about $900 cheaper, then people would really be all over them. You know?
Yeah, right. I mean, dude, that's a whole thing we could get into, or just this whole world of it's Atmos and headphones and binaural. I mean, most people are like, "What are you talking about?" But it's like, it's just funny how most people listen to music on headphones and it's what that full experience can be like and where that might go. But yeah, this is about as fancy as it gets as for listening on headphones, I guess.
Yeah, no doubt.
Although it keeps going. I've seen it get even crazier and crazier. Bespoke headphones.
Yeah, whenever you get into any luxury level with anything, the diminishing returns have a very clear line, you know. Yeah. And I think that the Audies headphones are right at the top of where if you spend any more, you're just doing it to get buy something for the sake of saying,
"Hey,
I have
some diamonds on the outside."
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, man. Well, all right. So let's hop into this conversation here. I'm really excited to get into your story a little bit, you know, because I know you, I know your work, but I want to know, you know, how you became you. So, you know, in your experience of being a person who, you know, started figuring out how to play instruments, understanding yourself a little bit, understanding what you were drawn towards as a musician, and on a consciousness level, you know, it's really important, I know, in your work as well. What was it that came clear to you? What thought hit you that helped you go from an ordinary person just striving to make music to someone who is successful and a thriving artist? And there are no rules. We can fast forward. We can go through several turning points for you. Whatever comes to mind, let's share that pathway.
You know, I was thinking, well, thanks for the question. That's a beautiful question. And I was thinking about what music means for me and the process it is now. And I realized that like the process of discovering that was like a sleeper process. You know, it almost like snuck up on me over the years. And I think I was originally trying to do something else in a sense with music, but this other thing emerged that was far deeper and more meaningful. I didn't actually so much try for that to happen. It just arose. And but if I take you back to the 2000s, I was living in New York City. I had gotten out of school and I was a late comer to music. I actually got into piano in college. I'd always done music in like elementary school and played recorder and saxophone and choirs and musical theater. Anything with music, I was down. I really enjoyed it. But it was never like a solo thing. It was always this group stuff in school. And in college, I got really into piano because the college, like the Steinway daughters apparently went to this college, Vassar College, like 100 years ago. And so their dad bestowed the college with a lot of beautiful pianos, so really old vintage ones. And the college tunes them. They keep them up. Yeah. So I had never played a nice instrument before. Like I'd only taken piano lessons for a couple years as a kid on a piece of crap upright Baldwin that just didn't sound good, you know. Yeah. Lo and behold, you don't want to play. I didn't realize I'd never like played just like a C chord on a really nice instrument. And when I did that, it's sort of like it started to feed itself. Like literally the sound coming from the instrument was pleasurable. And, you know, when you sit at a piano, it vibrates through the wood, and it's the sounds coming right at you through the soundboard of the hands even. And I was just into that. And a friend taught me how to play just chords, like reading guitar tabs, but now I could just do it on a piano because I couldn't really sight read that well. And that opened up a whole universe of being able to sing and play along to just pop tunes, whether it was the Beatles or anything, Billy Joel or anything. And now I was like having a good time. And then I started writing my own songs because I just, the same chords, and you can write your own tunes. And then I was really off to the races from there. And so when I moved to the city, the first big thing that happened was the digital revolution happened. And that was right around 2000, 2001. And so I was about to buy, it's one of the dumbest and best ideas I ever had. I was like, I inherited $2,000 from my grandmother Baba's passing. And thank you, Baba, for this. But I was like, oh, I have a great idea. I just moved to New York City. I'm going to buy a motorcycle. I don't know how to ride a motorcycle, but I was like, this will be a great, this is a wonderful idea. Just cruise around New York, I can park. Never thought to myself that I should really seriously learn how to ride first. This is what people who are like 20 do.
No doubt.
And so it was on eBay, and you know, I was the highest bidder on this Yamaha Vulcan, which is a pretty serious sized bike, like a ridiculous idea to get, like, might have been 1200 cc's, I don't know. And it was on the Upper East Side, and I was down in Brooklyn. I also remember thinking, like, when I buy this, I think I thought, like, I just go get it, like, just start riding it down, which is also a death wish. Uh-huh. I literally didn't know how to ride a motorcycle. And there were seconds left on the auction, and I was about to win it, and someone swept in and bought it away from me. And I was, oh my God, they robbed me of my motorcycle. And I was deflated, and I thought, I don't know what to do. And then it hit me. It's like, well, maybe I'll use this money for something else. And I met this guy, told me about the M-Box just come out to record on your Mac, that little interface to plug in.
Yeah.
And so he told me to check out Sweetwater, and I called up Sweetwater, and they...
And they've never stopped calling you since.
They called me yesterday. Yesterday.
Of course they did.
Same guy. Same guy.
Of
Brian
course.
Loney. Who's Dude, a nice got, guy?
Yeah, Alan from Sweetwater. He's been calling me for 20 years, man.
It's amazing. Like,
it's also, no, sorry to just totally derail, but that's
no,
something
please.
That people, any musician listening to this is laughing right now because the Sweetwater call, I just picture them getting more and more extreme. Like, I'm just always waiting for the time when there's like a phone message for them or where they're like, hey man, it's Alan from Sweetwater. I'm actually tied to the radiator right now, and my manager has a pair of pliers. And if I don't make
any
sales,
I'm on a hunger strike until you call me back. Yeah,
yeah. But I don't make sales by 6 p.m. Anyway, okay, that's amazing.
But we have free shipping. Yeah.
Or they're like, hey, just thought you might want to check out this new $9,000 synthesizer. Whatever. Yeah, it's like, I'm sure. Okay,
crazy
great.
Shit. Yeah. We were on tour once. Their headquarters is in Illinois. I think,
right.
If I'm correct, or Indiana. Some
Indiana,
interesting.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's right.
And we were driving by and we saw a sign for like Sweetwater headquarters, and it was as if we were driving by Mecca. We're like, oh my God, it's actually Sweetwater. Like, should we stop? I don't know. pay a tithing.
You should have gone in and found your guy in there and been like, hey, tables are turned.
Can you imagine? He's like on lunch and he just pays me no attention. He's like, I'm not working right now, man. And I'm like, but I'm here. You invited me. Yeah. 20 years ago.
You said if I ever needed anything. You know? Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. All right. So sorry. All right,
well, he convinced me. Yeah. So anyway, I bought some stuff and I started recording my first record in my little tiny place. And actually, I was in Soho at the time. And that was my first record. And it was not a good record. But that was probably like 30, 40 records ago. And I started making music. What I'm getting to is that I was making music. I did enjoy it and I loved it, of course, but I was chasing that fame game and trying to do it because I thought it would get me more attention and feel more accepted by the world, I think. And so I was pushing hard. I started a band for years, and I was the band leader and the guy pushing it, and it, I would gain members and lose members and have alcoholic drummers and the whole thing, hustling around New York City, moving drum sets and my keyboard and doing the thing in the Lower East Side. And fast forward to like 2008, there was the financial crash that happened, almost happened, the end of the world, part one. And here we are again.
Yeah, this time it's pissed off.
Yeah, Occupy Wall Street. We put a lot of fingers and band-aids on the dam at that point, and they're still holding, barely. But things weren't really working out as far as the band, and I was really like pushing up and holding up a lot of collapse. And I want to put a pin in that, because if we bring that to today, I think there's a through line there.
Yeah.
But I started to just in that collapse, like be like, you know, I think I was just kind of worn out and burnt out. I was like, I'm going to make music just for me. Like, I'm so tired of trying to like win and like sell and succeed and pander.
Yeah.
And so I started making music for me.
That's a huge insight. Like, I'm curious, what was it really that got you to understand, that helped you understand that art is only really successful, or even like, even someone who's an entrepreneur, like whatever the thing is, the goal that you're going towards only ever really comes until you stop trying to do it for external reasons and start trying to do it for yourself. It always works that
I
way.
Know it sounds obvious, but I didn't understand that. I really didn't. Sure.
Yeah. What helped you recognize that?
So what helped me recognize it, this is a spoiler alert, is psychedelic mushrooms. But I'll explain what happened, because it was so beautiful. So I started making that music just for fun. And it really purposely anti-commercial. Like I said, I'm going to make stuff that's instrumental, long form. It's just for me to like meditate with, and inspired by some experiences I'd had with music and mushrooms combining. And it's not really a genre, and I don't think, and I'm not going to perform it ever. I'm not even going to ever figure it out. I just want to do this to use it as a meditative tool. So I did that, and I was really having fun, because it was so experimental too. It's just like, what am I enjoying? And every time I felt that particular feeling of like infiniteness or this emotional quality from a certain memory, I'd go in that direction. And I remember doing it on headphones. That was a big deal, because it was something about this, when you put on headphones, it's a very like internal, personal listening experience. It just feels like you're in your own world as opposed to speakers.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that was some kind of thing I wanted to do, but I'd wear headphones and just sort of like play chords and waiting until the chord progression was like, oh, yeah, that, okay. And then I was, because there were no rules, I would field recordings I'd throw in there, and I was getting into hiking and backpacking, and I was getting into my first invitations into ayahuasca and different ceremonies. And because of that, I was really getting into meditation to prepare. So I was really going through a lot of internal change because of this external and internal collapse. And the field recordings were of all these beautiful nature places, like in the Adirondacks, and I was hiking into wilderness places that I hadn't been in since I was a kid in Oregon. But when I was a kid in Boy Scouts, I didn't really feel that charge of it in my mind. It was more just like, I don't know, you're a kid, they tell you to go out there and you're jerking around with your friends. But now, going through these medicine experiences and the meditation, something had changed in me. And when I would go into wilderness, it was like, wow, oh my, just maybe it was also the contrast from New York City too, but I was so just like turned on by wilderness. So I was making these field recordings of sounds that you'd hike into some remote lake or something, and you'd hear the crickets or the wind. And I realized that when I would listen to these recordings in my room, at this point in Brooklyn, I still felt that feeling, like it was imbued into the field recording somehow. And I was just blown away by this. So I started putting those into the music. It almost felt like cheating, because it was like, it made the music good, even better. It's like, wow, my God, I just threw in like this wind, and it's like the soul of the wind is, I stole its spirit. But it was just getting experimental that way, not to be weird, but because I didn't feel like, oh, it's a pop song, or I have to do by these structures or anything like that. And fast forward to a year later, I had essentially a record, and I thought, because it was inspired by mushrooms, just a certain feeling I'd had a couple times, I was like, I think I want to take mushrooms and now just listen to this, which was always the plan, but it was no big deal. So I took some mushrooms, and I remember going on a walk waiting for them to kick in, and I walked up to like Brooklyn Heights, and then I felt, oh gosh, I'm starting to feel kind of weird. And I walked back to Dumbo, and my apartment was under the Manhattan Bridge. So every couple minutes, this huge train would go over, and it's this big old factory building. And I went inside, and I think the headphones would also block out the train. And I put on my headphones. I remember lying down on my bed, and I hit play on the record to lie down and listen, right when things were really starting to kick in with the mushrooms. And it's like, all I can say is my life completely changed. And it's because the mushrooms allowed me, like, this piece of work I was so familiar with, now I couldn't figure out how I made it. I was just experiencing it because of the psilocybin, which is weird and wild. I was just in it now. Right. And all of a sudden, I was like hearing all the places I'd been from the field recordings for the last year. Like, it's my whole life from the last year. And I didn't intend it to be this way, but like, my mother was in there, and my friends, the city, the wilderness, and the music was just connected journey. It was only 45 minutes, but it was like all these synchronicities were happening as I was listening to this personal meaning for me. And it felt as if my soul had tricked my ego into making this musical tool to use in that moment to transform me and help me release things and just become into a new state of being. And that was the most beautiful thing that had ever happened to me in my entire life. I remember when the record finished, I just like took the headphones off and was just like exploding with gratitude and just awe. And I stood up and the whole room was like flexing. And I didn't know it at the time. I knew something had changed fundamentally. Like it was, but it was the birth of whatever this East Forest project. I mean, that was the moment. And after that, all I wanted to do was give this thing away and just be in the spirit of the gift, because that had so much meaning for me. That was enough. But I thought anything else is extra. Whatever this was, it was given to me. I certainly didn't devise this or plan this or manipulate this. I never wanted to sell it. So now it's just in this gift. And I started to do that. And I remember my girlfriend, I thought, well, maybe she wanted to have a journey to it. So I sat with her, but I thought it wouldn't have the same meaning, because I'm like, well, this was my life and my field recordings and so forth. But she had a profound experience. And I remember she got to speak in her journey with her recently deceased father, and they had all this entangled trauma she got to work out in this journey. And that was interesting. I was like, that's odd. That's cool. And then my roommate, and I gave it to a friend, and then another friend, and one of these friends got really obsessed with it, the record itself, and he wanted me to play some circles and some groups of people. And I was reticent, because I didn't really know what he was talking about, how to do that. And he just pushed me into it, and we started playing for groups, like our own underground community, and doing ceremonies. And then I started trying to figure out how to play for more than, like, play around the record, essentially. So there's more music and looping, and then bringing the field recordings into that. And that's what I started doing that. And we just did this for years and years and years. And then it turned into like thousands of people. And then it turned into a plant medicine church. And it still was just underground. But something was emerging. And I started to realize, as you say, that all of this came from me letting go of my own, like, thinking or pandering or trying to manipulate something into what I think what was needed or what was wanted or what would be accepted, I should say, and how people would accept me. And as soon as I could let all that go and follow my own excitement, my own bliss, really, of like, what is really the thing that I need, the medicine that I need, it became something much more authentic that, lo and behold, other people have that same yearning It's some kind of fundamental human thing. And then, it took me a while to realize that that's really what good art and art is it's a reflection of our own human experience, and we're all humans. And so we're all looking for that kind of authenticity in other art, in other conversations, and really everything. We're looking for ways to feel more in touch with that inner longing that we all have for something more, for something more present and real. And that process is what showed it for me. It's unfolded and evolved since then in many, many ways. But that was by far the genesis that I was like, that was a huge shift.
Beautiful, beautiful. So there were a couple of things you touched on, various points throughout what you were just describing. They were all really important things. And they're fundamentals when it comes to, either being creative or, your own self-exploration and just becoming a better version of yourself. One of those things is you mentioned that every time you were working on music in the early days and you tuned into a certain chord, a certain texture of sound, or listening to a field recording, whatever, it gave you this excited feeling and you leaned into that, that you didn't waste that feeling that came, you chased it and you, when it came into you, you recognize it was important, and then you went and you did something with it. That's one. That's crucial, fundamental thing. Because of course, like as people who are creative or just as human beings, we're just receptacles, and these moments and these feelings and these ideas are just like passing through space. And when we're lucky and one of them hits us and we feel it, and it's like, it's so clear if we're feeling it. It's like, does this taste good or bad? It's just, there's no thinking about it. It's like you feel that excitement and that just magic of one of those things. And where have you learned to let that be an indicator of when and you do something, how you do something, why you do something is an incredible guiding force. Ultimately, it's really the only guiding force you need at the end of the day. If you only listen to that, you would do very well personally or creatively. Another thing you mentioned is generosity. Just having a profound experience yourself and being so authentically connected to what that experience meant that you realize it was more important than you being celebrated for it, you making money off of it, whatever it is. You thought, I just want to share this with other people because this feels so good to me, that I want other people to feel that way. And it was healing for you and transformative, and you want other people to feel that. That's another huge part of it, because not only is that just a valuable thing to do, but it also shows, it's like a litmus test for yourself that you've really gotten to this honest place with your own creation that you have to get to if you want to create something great. Because if you're not at that place where you're like I sort of have this thing where if I'm working on something, I'll be like almost feeling like I need to get it to this place. I'll be patient, but I want to get it there before I die. Like that could happen right now or in a day or in a week. I just know it needs to be done before I die. And when it gets done, I'll be able to relax a little bit. And it's the same type of thing. It's like, I know this is going to be really valuable for someone because it's valuable for me. So I want to make sure that it gets done. Like the whole completion phase, I want to get that done so that other people can feel this. So it's kind of the same thing, And also like there's a real powerful and palpable truth behind when you're generous like that. And there's a trick to it. It's like, it's a devilish little sort of magic. Is that when you're selfless and generous like that, it does seem to come back to you in this bizarre way, but you can't do it. You can't have the thought that I'm going to do this so that hopefully something happens to me in return. Every single time where I have like no mind, zen, gone, just responded to something and be like, I'll help you out with that. Just let me know. Or I've done something without even saying anything to anyone. I'd never even think about it. I just did it. Then boom, it comes back. And it's one of those things where there's been times where I've thought like, well, I'll do this nice thing because hopefully, like maybe, it never works, it never works. This podcast is sponsored by AG1, the daily foundational nutrition supplement that supports whole body health. I drink AG1 every single day because, you know, I don't like having to have a lot of different supplements. I like taking supplements. I have experimented with them for over a decade and really found what the good ones are and what the not so good ones are. And the best thing about AG1 is that it combines kind of a bunch of different things you could be taking into one simple formula. So every time I take it, and the reason I take it every day, I notice better energy, better mental clarity, and a better ability to sustain my work throughout the day. So it's really great. Also, knock on wood, I never get sick. And I imagine the AG1 has something to do with that too. It's super easy. You just take one scoop, mix it with a little bit of water. You drink it. It tastes good. It tastes healthy. It takes 20 seconds and you're good to go. This stuff is blowing up. I live in Austin, Texas, as you know. There's AG1 billboards. It's on the sides of buses. There's, you know, planes flying through the air with banners. It's everywhere, and that's because it's great. So if you want to take ownership of your health, try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs, which I love those. I use those anytime I go anywhere. With your first purchase, go to drinkag1.com/astral. That's drinkag1.com/astral. Check it out. So I'd love to hear more about like your relationship to that inner knowing of knowing whenever something feels exciting and how you learn to recognize what that is, what that feels like for you, and then what role that's played in the unfolding of everything for you.
Man, you're like an echo of like my past. I feel like this conversation is so salient for me right now because, you know, this kind of question becomes a lot harder when there's just more on the table and more opportunities and when money is involved and it's your job and you have like people working for with you and for you, and it gets so sticky so fast. It's almost like a reorientation that needs to happen daily, if not throughout the day. And it felt a lot clearer before. It's still clear now as I hear you speak about it. I'm like, it's not that complicated. You know, it's a kind of trusting and giving over, but that's sometimes hard for me to do. You know, I'm remembering what that feeling was like when I got off that bed and I listened to that first record, and it felt like something had been given to me, a gift, and it felt such a powerful gift that it would be just crazy for me then to like monetize that in a certain way or try to manipulate it because I was given so much. And there's a real balance when you want to share something and then you're inside a system that does monetize things. That's the way things get out. And on top of that, it's even a way that we, through our own psychology, that we give value to things. I mean, you've already experienced, like you do an event for free versus you charge $5 or something. And it's interesting how people just will be like, I don't need to go or whatever. It's like, there's not much value given to it, even if they really like that thing.
Yeah.
But when they buy something, we've all made these sort of cultural agreements that a lot of it's unconscious and how we're like, that is now valuable to me, whether or not that's inside a broken system of growth. Mm-hmm. So I think if there's something I've been trying to shortwire a bit is this, it's the economy of scale. And trying to break that down where I'm not on a hamster wheel of thinking bigger is always better. Because that's definitely a sickness that is so pervasive and very insidious in how that just never ends, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I feel like what feels good is better.
Exactly. You know, because it never, you're never going to be satiated anyway, right? So it's like you got to change the litmus test of what's the barometer of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And what's interesting is that, and I'm sure you could speak to this and have experienced this too, is that when you don't know what it's like to gain success or notoriety or even just whatever, you know, profile raising in the world, more money, more flexibility, you know, more opportunities, all those things that come, like you think it's going to be one way and you also think it's going to make you feel a certain way.
Yeah.
But it's completely different and it's not, it's better in some ways if you are mindful and honest with yourself throughout the process. But it's also as good as it is, as you just described, it creates an equal amount of complicated problems.
Right, dude. Like, honestly, I didn't wake up one day and think of myself, oh, I'm successful. I still don't really take that label on. I mean, what does that even mean anyway? This has been such a gradual process day by day over 15 years that I think it's, as you say, like, you also have, it seemed a lot easier back in the day and a lot simpler.
Yeah,
and now I'm like, I feel more stressed out. You know, I'm more on the edge of burnout. And I mean, you're catching me after just getting back from a lot of traveling and touring, but that is though an interesting thing to reflect on. It's like, it's absolutely not the case that like the further you go along, it gets maybe easier. I think I thought it would. I really did.
Mm-hmm.
I thought also like the more boxes I could check of whether it was person helping me or label or whatever it is, manager, lawyer, whoever, the great people, but it doesn't necessarily, it also complicates things. There's more systems, there's more things to deal with, more, there's just more, and more is definitely not easier, is what I found.
and you're always trying to figure out like what is right, you know, monetarily, what's right morally, what's right strategy wise, what's right, you know, and it's a constant discovery process of like, okay, how do I want to deal with this? And it's just, it never stops, you know, and it's a good position to be in if, because you get to do what you want to do, but it doesn't mean that scaling things is going to make it any different per se. It means you could perhaps do what you want to do in a more grandiose way, but even that is going to create a whole new world of problems. And so I think the answer, and this is just, I've thought about this a lot in my own life too, is, and even more, you know, what you were just talking about, it's amazing. And we're just tuned in because over the last several months, I've been really thinking and reflecting on this a lot as well, is I feel like that, first, I've been really leaning into the opposite of what you're supposed to do in every situation.
That's like the George Costanza episode where he does the opposite of everything. Like, maybe that would finally lead to success because everything else was such failure. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and just being like kind of no matter what it is, like, everyone, like the industry, the kind of creative life, you know, this whole thing is there. I just see the patterns and people are all sort of doing things the same way because there is a certain number of things you can do that will give you a certain number of success or a certain level of success. If you just, you could get ChatGPT to just churn out stuff in a certain way and it would get to a certain level of notoriety on social media or whatever.
Noise, notoriety.
Exactly. And so what I think about is like, why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Why did I start doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Who was I when I started this and who have I become? And just like you were describing, it's like, I was talking about this the other day with a friend. It's like, I recognized recently I'm more irritable and more stressed out and less patient and less like deeply, deeply connected to this well internally. I'm still aware of it all, but I don't like just live in that space because these days I'm always moving forward. I'm always pushing and like there's so much complication and a lot of my brain has just grown over to have to deal with all that stuff all the time.
Dude, and, I love this podcast. Yeah. I feel like the other conversations we had, they were great, but they're more like conceptual. And this is so like vulnerable and personal of you. And like, I feel like, first off, you're speaking a lot of how I agree. And I bet a lot of people out there, there's threads here of connection and understanding.
Yeah.
And oh, I think it's beautiful. I think it's beautiful to speak to that. I mean, maybe part of it's us just getting older and we're like cranky old dudes, but
No. I think both of us understand that there's a balance to be had because, and you know, we've talked plenty of times, at least several hours and, you know, together over the years. And so I feel comfortable including you in this is that, because I really get this feeling from you, is that likewise, I feel like that both of us at the root of all the stuff, all of the, you know, weird complexity or stress or whatever it is, all of the kind of having to remember who you are and why you're doing things.
Yeah.
At the root of all that, both of us understand how precious what we know, what we're connected to is. Like the gift that you can give people with your music is invaluable. I feel like what I've been able to cultivate and give to people through my writing and through speaking has proven to be valuable to people. And both of us respect that so much that that becomes the thing that we go, I have to keep providing this. Because it's so important. It's so important to me. It's so important to other people. And so whatever it takes, like whatever kind of battles I have to do, whatever stress I have to deal with, whatever growing pains, and like if I have to live in discomfort for months and months, like I'm going to do it because this is the important thing, you know? And I think just for me, remembering that is really grounding.
Yeah, and I think if I could add another layer to that, I think for me it's less about, you know, whether I would do it or not. I do it because I have to, but I think what I really need to do is like stretch it out. Like you're taking time and I'm just stretching it out. So it's more like instead of things being so fast and so compressed, and that's part of the nature in like, okay, things have to be by this date, October. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, what if it was April the next year? I mean, what if? Because typically looking backwards in time, you don't typically think about how long it took. It's just like that thing was done and then the next thing was the other thing. And I could really do with like stretching the entire thing out so that there's more space in between the milestones as there were. Because I feel incredibly grateful to be able to, I mean, how amazing is it to be able to be creative or do something that feels meaningful to you and as a form of art? And then other people give a shit about it and want to listen. And you're in a relationship where you get to create and they participate in that process. And you can do that. And that's what you can spend your time on. That is the greatest job in the world. And I try to remind myself that, you know, just the other night we were at a show that was really, really hard. And from many levels. And you have a lot of feelings that come up of like, okay, this is it. I can't do this anymore. Like I'm completely broken. I'm done. Like I just can't do this. This is so demoralizing or difficult. And it's sort of like, well, part of it is just like not trying to cram too much of those things are going to happen, you know, but you have to like space things out. So not just like, and then you're going to the next and to the next, and then you have to create this other thing and this other deadline and then putting this other layer on it. So I struggle a lot with that edge of burnout. And then because in that place, I'm not making great decisions anyway. Like you said, I can feel more impatient and more irritable. I feel like so-and-so is not doing their end of the bargain and this and that, as opposed to like, look, things tend to work out.
Yes.
And I need to trust that original process that there is something coming through, whatever creative force that comes through all of us, that I am not in control of. I'm just sort of like the gardener. It was my friend MC Yogi was the one who told me this the other day. And he's like, look, if everything is divinity, if you hold that notion, then by you being worried and and manipulation and the control, you're essentially not really trusting all of it in divinity. It's like, so if you really say that you trust that and it's all one thing, then let it do its thing. I mean, you need to go through the process, but I think the rhythm is sort of falling back a bit into a place of more of like a walk and a saunter as opposed to a jog or a run. It's like, yo, bro, slow your roll. It's like, yeah. Where are you running to? You know what I mean? It's like, we're on a globe. You're going to come back. There's nowhere to go. So I think, you know, and there are many practices for some psychedelics or walking in nature. Or sometimes we get smacked upside the head to take us down a notch, to remind us that you don't need always be grasping so hard, that we can loosen the grip and it can be perhaps the same result or even more so. And I think that's what you were talking about the genuineness of when you give something, and that it isn't a kind of barter, but it's actually like, I want to be of service. And the more I remember that, that's what my project at least felt this was born out of. And that's very clear to me. And the more I can return to that, even that energy, perhaps it's just an invocation in the morning or throughout the day, to not get lost in the wheels and the knobs of perceived control.
Beautiful.
And manipulation or, you know, exchange.
Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful. That's one of the things I think about pretty regularly too, is like, there will always be, you know, times that are tough, challenges, things that suck. There will always be times where you feel good, times where you feel really optimistic and things are flowing. But the key is to sit in kind of witness to both of those things and not get attached and wrapped up in the drama of either, and just recognize, as you were describing, that that is the process of things just unfolding and being able to stay, you know, non-attached, but connected to the whole thing and be there with it. But don't let either of those things pull you into a space to where you're then not self-connected anymore.
Yeah, it's sort of like, I've heard some tenets in Buddhism and enlightenment is not that the desire goes away. It's just that you're with it in a different way. It's a kind of awareness and holding of all the things at once. And I think we have a perception that we're going to ameliorate certain feelings or transcend them,
right.
But we're not going to have those problems, right? Like, we're not going to get angry or lost or greedy or whatever, tired. You know, I mean, we're animals, and it doesn't take much to push us in very predictable ways. And sometimes I don't just give myself some slack and be like, look, man, you're crazy tired or jet lagged or this or that. It's going to seem different tomorrow. Your computer is not working right.
Right.
And I get still all wrapped up in these stories. But there's more, I think I want to cultivate more and more of that awareness where I see that. So I see the concurrent stories happening. I'm like, I'm not pushing that away, sort of that Ram Dass idea. I'm not pushing the dark thoughts away. I'm loving the dark thoughts. Mm-hmm. And by loving them, it's saying like, there's a place for you. I'm not going to give you the keys to the castle at this moment, but it's like a kicking and screaming child, instead of like arresting them with your hands and squeezing them or putting them in shame in the corner. It's like, let this fire burn out, but let's not put more logs on it. Mm-hmm. And I love you. I love you.
Yeah. No, that's it. That's it. Yeah, being able to recognize those arising emotions or impulses or whatever they are, and just, you know, realizing that your mind is this stage and this open system, and that everything that comes through you are just these mental formations.
Yeah.
And like everything else, they're impermanent. You know, they're just passing through you. They're not who or what you are. It's just the momentary arising of material in the mind based upon where you're at in that moment, what you've eaten for breakfast, you know, what someone said to you, what sounds.
Having a bad breakfast is enough to just throw off the day. Yeah. And let's go back to your original question about like, what is sort of like the recipe, or people who are saying like their process where they want to unlock something in themselves. Mm-hmm. And Yeah, I think about Maharaji Ram Dass's guru's teachers, like, they're basically like, what do we do? You know, what's the answer? And it wasn't that sexy. It's just like, love everyone, feed everyone, tell the truth. That's it. And I'm going to add one of my own little pieces on there, which is like, be creative. And when I say be creative, it's like, kind of do anything that's even the least bit creative. It could be free writing, doodling, arranging something in some creative way for fun. Sort of like what I was doing back with that music, is it was just being creative, not for a particular purpose of selling. It's like not that manipulation. It's just creativity for the sake of the, hopefully the joy of whatever you have to enjoy what it is. Those processes of creativity is a form of allowing something larger than your mind through, or divinity, or that's the magic. Like, if we really want to have that inspiration come through, or the creative force, or to feel these juicier emotions and joy and the infiniteness, we need to show up in ways for it to come through. It just can be so simple to do. But creativity, to me, as well as Maharaji was saying, like service, and honestly, I think telling the truth, because that's a form of allowing, being creative with your emotional state and just being, letting it out by actually just saying what you're feeling. Sounds crazy. Not always easy to do. But these are all forms of, and service too, of sort of flowing with something beyond the control center, you know, our frontal lobe and so forth. And that is critical. Absolutely critical, but absolutely simple as well. And so people can overcomplicate this to think like, but I don't play piano, or I haven't mastered a craft. I'm like, irrelevant. We are creative beings. We're meant to create. We create all the time with almost every thought we have, but find the ones that feel playful and fun for you. It can be anything. And this is a classic artist way type thing. Like, you'll see the magic that starts to happen in your life.
It's so true. I mean, what you said is just really, there's a lot of wisdom in there. And particularly the bit about just creating and getting into that space of creating for the sake of fun. And it sounds so, and it sounds so kind of in the age of like analytics and creative strategy systems and all that bullshit. Like, just making something for the sake of making it. It's like, no, I got to be chunking out content every day for, it's like, no, don't worry about all that stuff. Like, if you want to make something really meaningful, something that cuts through the wall of content, then forget all about that stuff and just get to a place of experimenting and having fun. And then the thing will come, you know? And that's something that it's so weird that, you know, I've been creating music for over 20 years. And just recently did I really start focusing more on that phase, because it's not that I don't experiment, but it's like my creative process is one where I don't resist anything. Like, whatever arises, I just get out of the way, and everything that arises immediately materializes into the work. So I can sit down and write 2,000 words in an hour. I can create an entire song in 2 hours or 3 hours. It's because it's a pure cyclical flow of the imagination, and I don't ever get in its way. And what I found whenever I was trying to create something recently is I couldn't get into that state, and I was getting really frustrated and really annoyed. And like, that's one of the few things that can just really make me feel depressed and angry and all this stuff, is whenever I'm trying to create and I can't find that flow. And I realized, like, oh, this is a part of like my creative path that needs more blood in it. The space of like, hold on, let's not try and just, it's okay not to finish and not to have the answer. Let's get comfortable in the space of, let's mess around. Let's see what the options are. Let's experiment, and let's get back to just that having fun space. And
let's only mess around, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
In many ways, it's like exercising. You're like, ugh, I don't want to do it. And then you do it, and you're like, oh, I feel pretty good. You know, it's it's the same thing. It's the war of art. It's like that classic Stephen Pressfield book, right? There is always going to be resistance to it. It's a very strange thing. Like, why? Why? Yeah. It's only pretty much benefit afterwards. But for some reason, it's baked into us. Maybe that overcoming that little hurdle, or it's quite a big hurdle, really, in your mind to just actually do the thing, even if it's 15 or 10 minutes, is so honorable. Like, that in itself is the spark of, like, that's like chivalry, or that's God. That's like, you did it. That's all that matters, is that you got over that and you did something. And music, you're so right. Like Beck would say, look, when you're in the studio, you're just making noise. You can't think about it any other way. You're just making noise and just like throwing spaghetti around. Maybe some stuff sticks, because the worst thing you could do is go in and be like, okay, we got to write a great song or a great, oh my God, this is death knell. Like, people ask me all the time, like, what's the ritual you do before you record? I'm like, oh Christ, like nothing. Like, just, I was recording with someone once and they're like, wait, it's time out before you hit record. Shouldn't we do an invocation? I was like, absolutely not. Don't think about anything. Just, it's like, be terrible when I hit record.
Perfect advice.
Yeah. Like, make some mistakes, please. And it's like, it's digital. Like, we can record for a while. So you have to let go of the notion of results. And you start to realize that, like, just chopping that wood for 10 minutes even is unbelievably powerful. A lot of this has been verified too scientifically about the effects on the brain. I just had on my podcast, Susan Magsalman and Ivy Ross, that book, Your Brain on Art. And it's all it is just evidence and stories of the amazingness of what's going on just from listening to art. So let's say music, for instance, then to like participating in it versus making it versus improvising, all these different layers. But we're talking about like beyond just neuroplasticity, like longer lifespans, significantly longer lifespans, or holding off and staving off degenerative neural diseases. This is hard science. Just from participating in some form of creativity that can be as simple as just actively listening to a song you like. I mean, shit is wild.
It really is.
The good news is it's like you said, you nailed it when you're like, follow the things that excite you or that that is the key. Like, that's the thing showing you where to go. Like, just what excites you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's not only in creativity, but just in life. Like, that's one of my mantras. It's like, what do you do that makes you feel more alive? Okay, cool. Do more of that. Focus on that.
And be honest about it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Some people are like, oh, sure. Well, it's eating ice cream. I'm like, okay. But look at the full picture of it. If you need, would you eat more after that? Maybe, maybe not. Probably not. If you eat a second one or a third one, is that really what's making you feel alive?
Yeah. You know? And it makes you feel dead afterwards. Like, you feel sick.
It's the full spectrum of the experience. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, hey, you know, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And it's been great. Beautiful time talking to you and just learning about those deeper and inner layers that I had no idea about, man. So thank you so much.
Oh, anytime. I love these conversations around creativity, sort of demystifying it and bringing it back into the conversation, because sometimes the obvious is the most devious, as my dad used to say. And it's just right there in front of us. And I really do believe it's our birthright. And a lot of it is emancipating ourselves from the world of content commerce and shifting it into play and fun. They can collide, but it has to start in that genuine place of like, whatever excites you is going to excite some other people too.
Wise words. Yeah. If you don't like it, no one else will.
That's for sure.
And what's the name of your new record that's coming out?
So the new record's called Music for the Deck of the Titanic, which I know that's been more in the news, the Titanic lately. That was, of course, not planned. But it's a studio record of mine that I'm really proud of, because it's got a lot of grooves in it and live instrumentation. It's got some lyrics. Behold. So it's actually like some songs in there, songs. But there's still some deep cuts that people in the East Forest world would be comfortable and familiar with. But it felt like a cool evolution. And I was grappling a lot with the last few years I think like a lot of us, with feelings of confusion, at times despair, at times hope, anxiety, just this mashup of all this strangeness and collapse that we're in. And it often felt to me like when I would play shows or go play a festival or something, almost like, I'm like, I feel like I'm playing music on the deck of the Titanic, sinking slowly or maybe not so slowly.
Yeah.
And I was conflicted about that. But in one way, I thought myself as like, well, something seems to be dying, like when the Titanic was sinking. And that made me feel like I'm almost like a death doula. And it's about grieving. But I also realized that something else was being born. And in that, there's a celebration and there's a midwifing of something that's emerging at the same time. I think this is generational, but that's really the themes that the music and the lyrics are weaving around, is this idea of grief and birth. So it's kind of all the different things that I feel right now in this time that we're in.
Wonderful. All right. Thanks, man.
Peace. Thank you.